There are regions in Spain which sound as if they've been around forever, and yet in many ways they're just striplings, youngsters, in comparison to the venerable titans like Rioja or Sherry. They've become classics, and their wines have a classic feel to them, but in reality, their fame is relatively recent. The region, Dio Ribera del Duero, is a perfect example, and it will be the focus of our episode on Spanish wine brought to you by Brian Spain Domain. First of all, let's locate Ribera del Duero on the map. This is a region which stretches across the northern center part of Spain. It's almost shaped like a flying saucer, maybe a little bit like one of those space invaders, spaceships that takes you back a few years in the region of Castilla y León, but mainly in the provinces of Burgos and Valladolid, but also a small part of Segovia and Soria. Burgos and Valladolid are where the bulk of the wine is made and where most of the region's heavyweights are working their magic. The name Ribera del Duero means more or less the banks of the Duero River, or if we want to make it sound a little more fancy, the Duero Riviera. The Duero is one of the most important rivers in Spain. It runs east-west in Spain and then into Portugal and flows into the Atlantic. And it also has an impressive collection of wine regions, which rely in part on its valuable water. Here is a list of the Hall of Famers, Ribera del Duero, as we know. Then you have the other region of Douro. And then we go into Portugal, and there's a famous region called Douro. And finally, port wine, the famous Porto wine. In fact, the impressive Duero handsomely traverses the city of Porto, the beautiful city of Porto, before spilling out into the ocean. The name of the Dio actually comes from a wine made by the earliest bodegas. It was called Protos, and on the bottle were the words Ribera Duero without the del. It was on the label, and it's still there today. Today it is known as Ribera del Duero, but I have to admit it's not the easiest name to pronounce, even for native speakers, so many people just call it Ribera. And at a wine store in the US, shop assistants referred to it by RDD, employing that linguistic efficiency that so often characterizes American English. Basically, don't bother saying the word, just initialize it. Anyway, as I was saying, Ribera is a very old region and a young one at the same time. Why do I say that? Well, like so many parts of Spain, winemaking in what is today the region of Ribera del Duero goes back a very long way. Archaeologists have come across evidence of wine in an old Celtic town that they were excavating called Pintia, and they estimate that the town or the settlement goes back to 2,500 years ago. So that's a very long time ago. But we do know that the Phoenicians arrived somewhere between 500 and 700 years earlier than that, and they are said to have brought the art of winemaking to the peninsula, so that would have given it time to get up north. And then, of course, you had the Romans who were around there for a long time, and finally, in the Middle Ages, the monks, and then the general population which produced wine for local consumption. Towns were perforated with miles of tunnels built to store the wine under what was at that time ideal conditions for preserving it. Then you had the 19th century, which was sort of a boom for some areas which were supplying France. Then you had phylloxera, the plague that sort of decimated the vineyards. And then during the 20th century, there was some recovery. Wine drinking was widespread, but it was consumed in a different way, sort of as a part of the daily diet. It accompanied you and your meal. But after the war, the Spanish Civil War, there was a shift in wine drinking habits, And many bodegueros, the winemakers, were seriously thinking about changing professions, or at the very least, changing crops. And by the 1970s, some were literally ripping up the old vines and planting grains and cereals because, as one owner of a famous winery there told me many years ago, they thought there was no future in it. Why did they think that way? Well, part of the reason, as I mentioned, was that there were different drinking habits, but also another part had to do with the kind of wine the region was more famous for, which was a kind of rosé. And when they'd make rosé, or sometimes they'd make another kind called clarete. Now, this is an interesting subject, but it's also sort of a confusing subject, so I'm not going to get into it at the moment. But suffice it to say that the rosés and the claretes were easy wines to drink. They weren't particularly sophisticated, and beyond the locals, a lot of people weren't pounding on the doors to buy it. So that was one concern. They also made red wine, obviously, but much of it was produced without the modern techniques in mind, I'll put it that way, and made for locals, where the consumer wasn't particularly finicky about quality. As I mentioned before, the wine had a different purpose back then. It was something to accompany your daily meal, so people looked at it differently. Now, there were people who knew and knew well that you could make good red wine in that area. In fact, you could make very good red wine. And all you had to do was look to the legendary wineries that were around that area, like Vega Sicilia, for living proof. The name Vega Sicilia sounds like an Italian wine, doesn't it? But it is actually Spanish, and it is arguably Spain's most venerated wine in history. In particular, the wine called Único, which is aptly named, it means unique or one of a kind, is possibly the granddaddy of all classic aged wines, or it is certainly up there with the Olympians. Goes through an aging process from picking the grape to putting the bottle out in the market of no less than 10 years. So that's quite an investment in time and money. And obviously, the best vintages are especially prized. This is a winery that started out during the 19th century, and for a while there, it provided a lot of wine for the Rioja region, where it was bottled and sent off in many cases to France. But the estate was owned by a wealthy family, and by 1915 it was making a red wine so fine that it began to earn a very good reputation. And this was all thanks to a winemaker named Domingo Garramiola. He was known more affectionately as Chomin, so he got sort of the ball rolling there. The thing is, the wine really wasn't on the market. It wasn't for sale. At least this is how the story goes. The family would give away bottles to friends and loved ones, most of whom were members of Spain's high society, the aristocracy, nobility, industrialists. And my understanding is that if a stranger, someone who they didn't know, wanted to get their hands on a bottle, it would cost them a pretty penny. So, in a sense, the family had created a very effective marketing scheme, albeit unintentionally, if you ask me, but it was very good. You either were one of the select few that could get your hands on a coveted wine, or you had to prove that you had the buying power to acquire one. So, it sounds like it was a bit of a status symbol there. Now, how much of this is true and how much of this is sort of lore is hard to ascertain, but it is true that the wine's reputation began to grow from there. Then in the 50s and 60s and 70s, another winemaker named José Arandón created the famous Único, and from there, things really sort of began to take off, at least for them. They weren't the only ones. You had other winemakers like the Bodegas Protos, which I was telling you about. So that was more proof of the region's potential. But as I was telling you a few minutes ago, in the 1970s, the region was going through or experiencing an existential dilemma. Should it take a leap of faith and open up to the modern wine world or switch to another kind of agriculture? Fortunately for us, enough winemakers chose to stick to wine. And one of those individuals was a man named Alejandro Fernandez. He founded it in 1972, I believe, definitely in the early 70s, a winery known as Pesquera, which has also become one of the legendary wineries there and one of the founders of the DO. So there was a group of wineries and winemakers who were ready to go for it. And a request was made to create the DO, and it was approved in 1982, which happened to be the same year that a new family took over Vega Sicilia, the Alvarez family, and they too would have a profound effect, a positive effect, I might add, on that wine and its reputation, especially not just in Spain, but internationally. But that's another story. Anyway, a whole slew of wineries started doing wonders for the region. Ribera wines became popular very fast and managed to compete directly with Rioja for a place as a quality wine in the tough Madrid market. It's been there ever since. You'd be hard-pressed to find a bar or restaurant in Madrid that doesn't offer Riberas, and that's quite a feat, considering it's a fairly young region, and especially since this has been going on for many years now. In fact, I remember when they started to come in, especially during the 90s, and people were impressed by what they saw and drank. It was a newcomer of sorts, but there was something about it that sort of screamed of greatness. And if you had a dinner to go to at someone's house, it was a perfect dinner wine gift. You couldn't go wrong. So what are Riberas? What are they famous for? Well, simply put, they are red wines. And they are made mainly with Tempranillo. But in that area, sometimes you'll see that name. But a lot of times they will use the local name. And there are a couple of versions of it. You have Tinto Fino or Tinta del País. I think I've also seen Tinto del País. I think I've even seen Tinta Fina. It's the same difference. Some are varietals, while others are blended with small amounts of other varieties like Merlot or Cabernet. We are talking about generally full-bodied wines, rich in tannins. They can be sophisticated and complex. They make young wines, the jóvenes, then they have robles, which have a touch of aging in wood, and then you have your typical crianzas, reservas, and gran reservas. You can also find the rosés, the claretes. Ironically, the traditional wines in those areas, they are not as popular as they used to be, but they're sort of starting to come back. I think there's an interest in recovering a bit of tradition, which is nice. And there is a very little bit of white, but it's really not that common. And there's a reason for that. And that's because many of the big producers in Ribera actually have gone next door to Rueda, which is famous for its white wine made with the Verdejo grape. So they focus on their whites in that region. From a geographic standpoint, we have to look at these wines in more detail. This region is quite large. It's quite long, and it changes a lot in terms of about everything from altitude to soil to climate. That results in a wide variety, a wide array of reds within the category of red. Starting in the east is Soria, which makes only a small percentage of the total production and is probably the least known of these subregions. And yet the old vineyards there, the higher altitude and the smaller scale production, the smaller wineries, translate into a red wine which has its own personality, and it's definitely worth trying. Then you move west into the province of Burgos to a town called Aranda del Duero, which is one of the founding towns of this region and has an old reputation for good red wine. Then you move a little north and you come to towns like Roa, ROA, that's also in Burgos. Then you move over to the west, Peñafiel, another one of the centers of production. And then further to the west, to the province of Valladolid and to towns like Tudela and others. As a rule, and this is just a general rule, the further west you go, the more famous the wineries and their wines. They also tend to be the most expensive of all, and often the ones with the highest reputation. What has made these wines earn the name that they've earned? Well, it has to do with the soil. In certain areas, it's quite sandy. And then the great grape variety, the Tempranillo, which does so well with aging. And then you have the altitude, which averages somewhere around 850 to 900 meters. That's nearly 3,000 feet. Since the summers in Spain can be scorching, scorching hot, this results in very hot daytime temperatures that ensures the ripeness that you need. But the cool nighttime air will take the stress off the fruit and guarantee the right degree of acidity. And it is that combination that is great for aging wine and creating elegant reds. The price range for RDD, and I'm starting to use that term, Riberas, is somewhat elevated for Spanish wine standards, and or is there a little bit pricier than other places? The classics, with the crianzas and the reservas, will range anywhere from 15 to 30 euros, maybe 35 euros. For some, that may be a special occasion wine, but these wines rarely disappoint. Then you have the next step down, maybe the 8 to 15 euro range. Some of these could be the Robles with a touch of aging. They can be a very good value. And then there is a lower level than that. You often find it in the supermarkets. In fact, they are often the supermarket's own brand or own version. And they aren't bad. Just don't expect the sophistication you might find with others. And then finally, you have the high end. I mean the really high end bottles, the ones meant for a different budget, a different customer. Vega Sicilia, the Único, was traditionally the most expensive wine in Spain until the early 90s, but it has been dethroned several times over, I might add. During the 1990s, for example, a Danish winemaker named Peter Cicic blew the price cap lid off with his world-famous Pingus or Pingus, which today generally reaches the market at 600 euros and goes up from there up to several thousand, depending on the age and the vintage. And there are others. Anyway, wine tourism has grown quite a bit over the years, but you have to plan it out well and make sure you contact the wineries to make sure they're available. The big names are pretty well equipped for visits, but the small ones can be fun for impromptu tours. You just have to be patient. You just never know what you're going to find, but sometimes you might run into the owner and you ask a few questions, and they are often more than delighted to show you around. I've done this on a number of occasions. Winemakers are generally the nicest people in the world to talk to. They love their profession, they're passionate about their profession, and they love to share it with you. But sometimes these places are closed. It's a bit of the roll of the dice. There are plenty of places that you have to see. The town of Peñafiel, as I mentioned before, is one of the hearts of the region. It has this cool looking castle above the town. It runs along the ridge so that it looks sort of like a ship from a distance. And then on the western end, you have Valladolid, the city. This is a classic historical Castilian city. And then to the east, Aranda del Duero, famous for its roast lamb. And then there are dozens of towns in between. There are castles too, as well as luxury hotels located in old monasteries, old royal palaces, and other historic places. There's a national road called the N122, which runs east-west, and the stretch between Peñafiel and Valladolid. It's become known as the Golden Mile of Ribera wines. It's just littered with the famous wineries. Some are right off the road, others you might have to go a little bit further off the beaten track to find, but they're all pretty much there. The big names, as I said, but don't turn your nose up at the smaller wineries that dot the region. They are all over the place, and stopping by is often a wonderful surprise. I can personally attest to it. These days, basically every region makes something worth bragging about, but I have to admit I have a soft spot for Riberas. They have that combination of boldness and finesse that I find so attractive, but I'm not the only one who feels that way. The experts will say the same. In a matter of 40 years, this new, quote unquote, new region is now a legend in its own right. And that will be all for today's episode of Let's Open a Bottle, the podcast, the story of Spain's wine revolution. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and Castos. Or if you wish to support Brian's Spain domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, Spanish culture. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us regularly, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Cheers, or salud, as they say in Spain. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.